Hi, I'm Heidi. Welcome to Doggone Good Information. And welcome my co-host, Tommy Fahey.
Hi, Heidi. How are you?
Hey, Tommy. I'm great. I'm great. Always, I always look forward to spending time with you, if only online, but...
Likewise. It's been a little bit.
It has been, yeah. We've
been busy. A little hiatus.
Yeah. We're going to ramp it back up now. We got some really good topics coming up. I'm excited. I'm spending a lot of time really looking at guests and getting some really fun guests on the show, and also for my Animal Tales podcast. So, yeah, good things to come.
Yeah, super fun.
Yeah. So since we've not been in contact for a little bit, what's going on? Anything interesting in your world?
Well, I just got home from a horse show over the weekend.
Oh, okay.
So I took a couple of horses up to St. Louis to show at a dressage show.
Did Jimmy Dean go?
Jimmy Dean did not go.
Oh, okay. So he had his dog sitter.
Yes. He stays with some good friends of mine that have a similar size and age dog. It's his second family. But a lot of dogs did come to the horse show. Some good and some not so good experiences with that.
Yeah.
So the good ones, it was kind of an interesting dichotomy of things. A very good friend of mine was there with her German short-haired hunting dog.
Oh.
Which should be very high energy and out of control, right? But she's an animal trainer. So the dog is kennel trained. When she's out, she's on a leash. She has a prong collar on because she's very high energy and she will pull.
Right.
So she has all of the, what I would consider correct training tools.
Yeah.
To keep the dog under control in a public situation. Interestingly, there was another same breed German short hair there. At the dog show, had the same training collar on, same setup, and those were two of the most well-behaved dogs of the entire show.
Interesting.
And you wouldn't have thought that based on the breed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then there were some other dogs. There was one bully breed. I don't know exactly what cross or if it was full pit bull, what it was. Generally super well-behaved. Generally, the owner had full control over it. But I was coming back to check on the horses in the evening. I'd gone to dinner, then come back to do kind of a night check. And they were just down the aisle away from us. And I think it was just a matter of circumstances. But we talk a lot about dog behavior and sort of what's natural for them and that kind of thing. So the dog was at the far end of the aisle way. And I came in the door, kind of down a long, dark hallway. And that dog saw me, and he or she, I'm not sure, was super alert, started barking very aggressively. And the owner had stepped into a stall with the horse, so she wasn't right there with the dog. And I thought, here it is. This is how I get attacked.
Oh, boy.
You know, and I mean, we were probably 50 yards apart. It wasn't, she wasn't right on top of me. But I thought, oh my gosh, here we are. This is, you know, based on the breed, based on the situation, like, I'm going to get attacked. And I was like braced and ready to jump into a stall to get out of the way.
I was going to say, can't you jump over a stall? Come on, Tommy. You can't climb still.
Yeah. I was planning my exit strategy.
Yeah, sure. No kidding. Yeah.
Luckily, the owner jumped right out of the stall, took a hold of the dog, got it under control. And really it wasn't in any danger, but it goes to a discussion that we've had many times of having that kind of a breed. It's sort of like owning a loaded gun.
Yeah.
It's not if, it's when. And what triggers and how, you know, how easily is that dog triggered to go into a protective mode? And I, again, never blame the dog.
Yeah.
It wasn't the dog's fault. You know, it was just a circumstance where the dog was triggered.
And so wasn't it, tethered or wasn't in it, a, what, did it have any leash on?
It had a leash on, but it was just dragging the leash.
Oh,
she kind of let it loose because it was, like I said, generally well-behaved
dog
stayed right along with the couple of stalls that they had available for the horses. So, you know, I'd seen it all day long when it was a more busy barn, you know, more people around, the dog was much more relaxed. But I think probably the its human was probably a little more alert because the barn was quiet.
Yeah, it can be creepy. Yeah, in a barn.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, just an interesting thought of like that dog's behavior shifted and changed based on the scenario. And again, not a bad dog, but bred for a specific purpose.
Right. Has the ability to do some damage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then there was another dog.
Oh.
So early in the day, I saw this. It was an older woman with probably a year old German Shepherd. And I immediately thought, stereotype in my head, that is a bad combination.
Yeah.
That dog can pull her around.
Right.
And she has no control over it. And of course, it was wearing a harness, not any sort of a slip lead or a choke collar, a pronged collar, any sort of, device that a woman that probably doesn't have a ton of strength, would be able to be in control.
Yeah.
And I saw her from, way across the facility. I thought, oh, that's going to be a problem later. So I was watching some of the tests go in the dressage ring. And she was sitting a few bleachers down from me and in the front row, and there was a walkway across the front, and here came some other dogs, and that dog lunged and just barking and yapping. And dressage shows it's like watching golf. It's very quiet.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's not a lot of noise. We want everything, very quiet.
Which you've talked about before, which is why you didn't want Jimmy Dean necessarily.
Because
exactly. He sometimes wants to bark or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. He's generally very good, but if he's in my lap and another dog gets into our space, which a lot of people let their dogs get into
exactly.
our space, which is a whole other topic and problem, then he will bark at them to get them out of his space.
Right.
The German Shepherd had a little too big of a bubble, but she was, oh, he just wants to play.
Yeah.
And I thought, no, he doesn't. He is... One, obviously very nervous. He was high alert, vigilant, scanning the environment, eyes wide, ears up. This was not a relaxed dog.
Yeah.
And not being playful. He was being fairly aggressive.
Right.
So fast forward then, it was my turn to ride. So I was, it went through the warm-up. Everything was going well. Get into the ring, and somebody in the bleachers, there's the aluminum bleachers that have the chain link fence on either side, and they shifted and the whole thing rattled and shook, and my horse spooked out of his mind, just rattled his poor cage.
Oh boy.
So we started off our test with him being very, very anxious. But we got through it. Everything went fine. It was a bit of a tense test, but we got through it and it was fine. But coming out of the arena, the same woman with the German Shepherd was standing right at the exit gate
right.
with her dog. And, of course, other people were walking by with their dogs. And here we go again. That dog lunges and barks. The little dogs bark back at it. Now we've got dogs barking. I'm on a very tense horse who... is now super hyper alert.
Right.
And he's like, I'm not leaving. I'm not going over there near those dogs.
Oh, no.
So here I am now at this point, my life is somewhat in danger.
Yeah.
And my horse is in danger.
Yeah.
This is a wreck waiting to happen. Luckily I'm an experienced professional. I know how to work with the horse. I can see that there's a disaster ahead of me. So I don't just rush into it. I'm very aware. And I was safe through it. I actually had to have somebody come in and lead me out of the ring.
I was just going to say, that's what comes to mind. Yeah.
Yeah. Very luckily there was another professional there that was, had his eyes on it.
Reading
as well
it. Yeah.
Knew exactly what to do and helped me out of the ring. But it brings it to a kind of a bigger discussion of why did that woman think that dog should be there in the first place?
Right. The horse show folks have any criteria like a campground? They say, your well-behaved dog is welcome. Would anybody have asked her to, or was she just one of many with dogs that were barking and yapping and lunging? And
for the most part, at these types of shows, the dogs are very well-behaved.
Yeah. Horse people love dogs, by the way. Exactly. Most horse people have dogs. Yeah.
And generally speaking, they're all pretty well trained and well socialized and well behaved at the shows. I think, I'm not completely sure, but I think she was just there to watch. I don't think she was a participant interesting. In the show.
Yeah.
And that happens, with some frequency that people will come to a public venue and, even taking their dogs to a fair or something like that.
Because the dog needs to go.
Yeah. And they think they're doing something really good for the dog. We talked about this on a previous episode, the socialization idea.
Yeah.
What is it? What isn't it?
Yeah.
And this was obviously a dog that had not a lot of foundation training, didn't have the social skills to be in public. The handler did not have the tools to keep the dog under control in public.
What a shame.
And didn't have the awareness to say, this is not a good situation for us. And I am now impending on other people's, rights and safety.
Yeah.
And I should just remove myself and my dog from the situation.
Right. Yeah. I think that's our beefs is if you make the decision to go and poor decision, but you did it, the fact that you and I would see that half a mile away and they don't even see mm-hmm. it when it's on top of them and a really impending dangerous situation,
those are the reasons I don't take my dog
right
to these types of shows.
Yeah,
it's not that I wouldn't like to have him there. I'd love to, but one, I'm under a lot of stress and under a lot of pressure having two horses to work with, so not having my dog there takes that element out of it. Right. Two is that I don't know what other dogs are around, so I don't know what kind of a problem he's going to create because they're there.
Yeah.
And then, as a general idea that's sort of lost in the world, it's not all about me.
It's not?
Right. Apparently. I think we've lost that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I always say I'm in show business and I know a show when I see one. And some of these people just want to show off their animals. And I'm like, you know what? They get in show business, buy yourself a pop-up tent and get a mug joint. Have people take pictures with your pet for money. And,
there you go.
So I know a show when I see one. So, don't tell me it's about socialization or whatever. It's because you want to show your dog off. I don't take my dogs a lot. I have a big, beautiful poodle who everybody, oh my gosh, she's so pretty, party colored. But I'm afraid for him. And I have to be vigilant then. And it takes away my joy. And you know what? He's not going to be any happier because I took him to the farmer's market or the horse show or wherever. He's quite happy on the porch at home. And I come back and we play. And so. Well, Tommy, speaking of play, we have a really cool interview today with the gal who, her and her husband and family run a dog sled company. And we even talk about the Iditarod. Her husband has raced in the Iditarod, which just wrapped up. And what a fascinating lady. And she's getting into speaking, comparing the world she's in and the dogs and the sledding and the dogs working with inspirational life lessons. So... really cool. Tanya from Winter Dance Dog Sled.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Hi, Tanya. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. My pleasure to be here. We've been trying to make this work forever.
We have, and I appreciate your patience and just getting back to me. And finally, we make it work. I'm excited. This is a fun topic for us, right, Tommy? A dog sled talking about.
Yeah, I'm really interested to learn more about this.
Yeah, for sure. I think we have a trip in our future. And we could write it off, Tommy.
There you go.
So, Tanya, tell us, I was watching your story. Your website's amazing, by the way, and we'll put that in show notes because it's a heartwarming story. You and your husband bought a dog, never thinking you were going in the dog sled business. So tell us about that.
Oh, gosh, yeah, that goes back, I guess it'd be a little over 30 years now. And I was going to university at the time, and Hank is a millwright by trade. And just one night after dinner, we went to the mall. And there was this adorable red and white husky puppy. We fell in love with her. And 3 nights later, we brought her home. and thought we made the decision to add a dog to our family. And, you know, little did we know that night we changed the entire trajectory of our lives, right? What one decision can sometimes do.
Where were you living at that time?
At that time, we were in a place called Guelph, which is about an hour from Toronto. So, okay, yep. You know, a city. And, you know, so we had an apartment. So we brought her home to our apartment and she proceeded to destroy the apartment within the next couple weeks.
Yes.
Sounds right.
No doubt.
Yes, we were horrible dog owners. We had no idea what we got ourselves into. So, you know, in desperation to understand this crazy pup, we got every book we could find on Huskies. And one of those books was called Race Across Alaska by Libby Riddles. And as some of your listeners might know, Libby was the first woman to win that crazy 1,000-mile Iditarod back in the 80s. Mm. Well, when we finished that book, we far better understood this crazy pup, but we also had fallen in love with Alaska and the history and the culture behind this amazing breed of dog and the Iditarod. So that was kind of the start. And then we saw a movie, Iron Will. Some people might remember, a good 1990s Disney movie. I see Tommy nodding.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And you watched it and moved on with your life. And we watched it when we have dog sledding. And that's what started it. And then we got, we had two Huskies at that point. And so then we got Ice and Lucy. And I got Hank a sled for Christmas. And then we were dog sledders. So just for fun. And we went up to seven dogs, Adit Storm and Midnight and Mackenzie. So we each had a team. And, then I wasn't loving my job. Hank wasn't loving his, and we grew up on farms. So city life really wasn't where we want it to be. And one night on the phone, a friend said, why don't you close into business? And, you know, that was it. So, obviously there was a lot more in between that and starting the business, but that was the seed that, that started the whole thing.
And then you moved up to, is it Haliburton, Ontario?
Yeah, we moved to Haliburton, which was about 4 hours, you know, northeast of where we were at the time, and just bought 50 acres of wilderness and designed a house and a kennel for the dogs. And September 1st, 1999, we quit our jobs and still never forget that night, handing our keys to our house to our new tenants and two pickup trucks loaded with the cats and the dogs and all our stuff and headed north to our new home, because all we moved home to that night was the wilderness. Our house wasn't done. The kennel wasn't done.
Oh, my.
So we had a driveway and massive poles in the ground, had a phone that hung on a tree, and we had no hydro, no water, and I was 8 months pregnant with our first child. So it was a fall, I tell you. It's not, wow. You would never, ever plan for a fall like that, but that's what we moved home to that night.
Wow, what a, they say it's the things you don't do that you'll regret, so I don't think you'll have many regrets in life, right?
What an adventure. That sounds amazing.
Pulled the trigger.
It was an adventure. I mean, you know, when we speak to corporate groups, we say we learned two huge lessons that year. You know, we learned that for us, not saying it's the right move for everyone, but for us, kind of burning your bridges, burning your boats was magic, right? So I don't know that fall, had we not rented our house, quit our jobs, when snow started to fly and we had no house and a brand new baby that we wouldn't know what, you know what, like this was a great try, but let's just go back to what we know, what's safe, wasn't an option. And so when you have no options, it forces you to become incredibly resourceful to find a way forward.
Yeah.
And the other big lesson we learned was how important support team was. Because when you're chasing a big dream, a big goal, a big vision, most people don't see what you see. But having even one person who does, for me, it was Hank. For Hank, it was me. Because our family and friends thought we were crazy that we'd walked away from, you know, great jobs, great careers, a lovely house to move to the wilderness. So days that I was like, what have we done? He was that support for me. And days that he had those days, I was that for him. And without that support, you know, I don't know that we would have kept going.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Two great lessons for sure. I fall under the people wonder what I'm doing often. Tommy's,
to be fair,
Tommy's my go-to.
We're each other's sounding boards usually.
Yeah, for sure. When other awesome. People don't get us, right?
Well, wasn't it Walt Disney? They said if he pitched a new idea to his team and most of them said it was a great idea, he wouldn't do it. And if most of them said it was horrible, he would do it.
That sounds about right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
So when you got up to Haliburton, did you have to, like, did you automatically know it was a place where there would be good trails for the dog sleds, or was that part of the vision at that point?
It was part of the reason we ended up in Halliburton was because of the snow, to be honest, because Southern Ontario doesn't have, and it's already gotten tons worse in the last 25 years, but Halliburton is known for having great snow.
Oh, okay.
So we knew we had that on our side, which obviously was important. And then it also had lots of tourist accommodations, so from resorts to cottages, B&Bs, so, and 3 hours from Toronto, so we figured, you know, marketing, logistic-wise, it was a pretty good location yeah. for a business. And then we just started making partnerships. So we, you know, made a deal to run tours at two of the big resorts that were here at the time and a couple of the smaller ones. And then another company let us use some of their land for our longer tours. And that's how we got started. So,
oh, neat.
It was interesting looking back how the different business owners interacted with us. I mean, a lot of them were like, oh, yeah, you're welcome to do your tours on our property and we'll send you our guests. And then I'll never forget one business owner who he told me afterwards, he said, you know, you walked in the door and I went, you could fill my resort with the guests that are going to want to come and do what you do. And indeed, over the next 2 or 3 years, and even today, most of that resort's business in the winter are our Doxla customers. So everyone else didn't see that big, but he saw that I could actually help his business, not the other way around.
Wow, pretty
That's
neat.
That's wonderful.
So Tommy and I are animal trainers. And so I'm curious about how you get a dog and you're learning about the dog, and then you parlay that into the dog sled business. How does one train a dog sled dog? I mean, is there some innateness to it? What does that look like? I'm curious about that.
I wish I could say we're such great animal trainers like you guys are, but that is just not the truth. For us, huskies love to run. Mm-hmm. So having a husky become a sled dog is just like you saying you trained a lab to jump into water. it takes no training, right? I mean, the dogs instinctually do it. So, of course, we help condition them. We help them, you know, learn the nuances of which side of the line to run on. But the actual desire to run and be part of a team, that's as in them as any trait is in any dog. It's just, it's what they love to do.
What does the start and stop look like? So I get that, and I listened to your TEDx talk, which we'll talk about in a minute, but you're talking about Hank taking him out and a pretty fearful, crazy trip, which I'm sure most of them are out there. But how does the start and particularly the stop work? I kind of get that they'll follow the trail or that type of thing, but like, how do you keep them from going that direction and going that? We do gi and ha on the horses and that, but is it similar?
Same, gi and ha. I mean, very few people know those words, so this is like amazing.
yeah. And depending on where you are, it's gi or gi.
Yes.
I've driven a lot, and some people say gi and ha, and some people say gi and ha, so.
That's fair.
Interesting.
But yes, we use gi and ha.
Okay.
Same thing. So our leaders, so the front dogs that you see at a team are your brains. They are the magic behind everything.
Yeah, for sure.
And so they know gi and ha, and they will go by command. The rest of the dogs generally, usually the first two dogs right behind your leaders are pretty strong leaders too.
Oh yeah,
And everybody else follows them. So, you know, it's very similar to driving a team of horses.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, your leaders are your gold.
Right. It's interesting.
So you're probably using more experienced dogs to train younger dogs also. So they're following
Absolutely.
By example. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a veteran leader can train a new dog in a heartbeat where it would take us maybe 6 months. Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
So yeah, they can train each other so fast.
Yeah, people don't realize the value of that. In good and bad, they could train your animals. Your animals could train your other animals to do bad things too.
Yes, they can.
For sure.
Like bark incessantly, and you know.
Yes, or in our case, we had a dog that Maverick was his name, one of Hank's great leaders, and Hank, as Hank said, he can't take credit. Maverick was just a brilliant animal, and Maverick learned the command "come ha," which means to turn a team 180 degrees. And spin them, even a huge team, so that everybody stays straight in the line. Nobody gets tangled. It's just this absolutely brilliant pivot. He's the only dog we've ever had that could do it. But when he started doing it, Hank was like, oh my gosh, I have a dog that'll come. Oh, he's like, good Maverick. He's praising him. Well, then Maverick's like, anytime he felt that Hank wasn't happy with what they were doing, he's like, okay, he gets happy when I come off. So then he would just randomly start. Don't join the team now. So yeah, you have to be careful with those positive reinforcements.
Yeah, exactly.
That's too funny. Much of a good thing.
Exactly.
That's funny. Tommy, I interrupted you a second ago. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right. So you were talking about starting the dogs. You're using experienced dogs. And then you said a word that we talk about often on the podcast, positive reinforcement. What sorts of training tools do you use in training the dogs? We talk all about the quadrants of operant conditioning. And there's a lot of discussion and talk on not using anything but positive reinforcement. Where, as a professional entity, where do you fall on that spectrum?
Everything we do is positive. From the time a puppy is first born until we're starting a 1,000-mile race and going across Alaska and Yukon, everything is positive. Why would an animal possibly want to do what we want it to do and not love it? I mean, we wouldn't want them to do it if they don't love it. So, you know, when we first start our training runs in the fall, the dogs will run maybe a mile, and then it's fun. Everybody's happy. They come back. They get treats. Everything's happy. And then gradually we start increasing the distance, increasing the conditioning. But it always has to be fun. If at any point it is not fun for them, then we've screwed up. Then we have asked too much. We haven't bred the team properly, because it's all about fun. If when we're training for 1,000-mile races, if Hank starts seeing the team's mood come down a little bit, then what he'll do is, A, he'll give them a day off. And then the next run they do will be, if they're expecting to go a 50-mile run, he'll maybe take them out for 5 or 10. And it's about stopping. It's about playing. It's just about having a great time. And then they're like, right, we do this because we love to do it. Because, I mean, that is what sled dogs do. They run because they love to run. So taking that away in any way, shape, or form is the last thing we would ever want to do.
Right. But even like the, you know, if you, as the dogs are not working when they're being fed or that kind of thing, just to have like proper manners and that kind of thing, I assume that's important with the amount of dogs you guys have and having your kind of schedule and how you work with them and such. And I've been around Huskies.
To be honest, our guys are pretty much what Huskies want to be. So we don't generally train to sit, to heel,
right,
any of those things, because it's not important in what we do, to be honest.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we want them to be who they are, because whether we're talking dogs or people, who is happier than somebody who is being who they truly are? So we don't try to teach them to be something that they are not. I mean, obviously, if there's really bad behaviors, because we do bring in rescues, we do bring in, you know, dogs have had really tough lives. But even that, it's all positive reinforcement to get them out of whatever behavior they're having. So, but yeah, you won't walk. We've been shooting a movie this winter, and we can't say anymore because of all the agreements we signed. But, you know, they're like, oh, can your dog sit? And we're like, well, I'm sure we can get there. But that's really not a trait that our dogs are trained to do. Thankfully, they were hired to be sled dogs, so that worked just fine. But yeah, I mean, being sled dogs and running, That's what we love for them to do. So our guys go out and they destroy their yards. They dig like crazy. They do what dogs do.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing about Huskies I do know. They like to dig.
They love to dig.
So they have a place there. They could do a lot of that, right?
Yeah, we have 3 big yards. It's probably about 3 acres in total. And so everybody gets yard time every day and in different groups. So they go out and play and dig, or, you know, the old guys will find a nice sunbeam and sleep. But yeah, lots of time to do whatever they want in the off season.
Yeah, I assume you have them in groups of some sort, because all together isn't necessarily a setup for success either. It's just a bunch of loose Huskies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We don't want 500 dogs.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's personalities that do not get along, like any group of 150 of anything. So yeah, so the young guys go out together and the older guys. And yeah, it's all tailored to who they get along with best.
Awesome. A feeding time, but the expression feeding time at the zoo, right? I mean, we've had a lot of animals in our family, and feeding time is very noisy, and I can only imagine, because Huskies are verbal too.
But that said, I mean, feeding time or getting ready to go run are the only times that they're noisy. I mean, most people around here have no idea we have that many dogs because generally they're not noisy.
Awesome.
But yes, dinner time, that's the exception for sure. Or yeah. Just, you know, 5 minutes before the hooks are pulled and the teams head out on the trail, then it's pandemonium too.
Oh my gosh, can imagine. So do you do any, I was in New Hampshire, my son lives up in Vermont, and I visited a place and they did summer grass runs. Do you guys do any of that? And do you do it for tourists or just for their own exercise? Or?
Yeah, sadly, Ontario, we just get too humid in the summer.
And, oh, okay.
You know, if you have the mixed breed huskies, you can get away with more, but we have the Siberians, so those heavy, heavy double coats.
Right.
So 10 degrees is, sorry, not Celsius, but 50 Fahrenheit is our threshold for training temperatures.
Okay.
So if we're under that, we can train. If we're over that, we can't. So it pretty much rules out the summer. So the only thing we do in the summer, we do have a couple nighttime events where I shouldn't say nighttime, evening time, where people can come and meet some of the dogs and learn about the races and stuff. And then we do hook them up to a sled on wheels and literally run like, you know, maybe an eighth of a mile, like not far right. enough that they would overheat or get too hot, but just so people can see the excitement and what a team of sled dogs is like.
It's gotta be amazing. I know the Iditarod just wrapped up, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
You guys have had an Iditarod experience, or some of the folks who are on your team. I looked at your About Us page.
Yeah.
What does it take? So you're in Haliburton, Ontario. How do you mm-hmm. get the animal? Is it a truck? I mean, are they flying? How are you getting up to, and how much equipment do you have to take, the sleds and all that? Or do you use equipment from up there? It's just a logistics thing, but I'm more curious.
It's a logistics thing, that's for sure. So yeah, we do drive the dogs from here to Alaska, so we can do the drive in 5 days.
Okay.
They drive hard. We stop every 3 hours. The dogs are off the truck just to stretch and, you know, bathroom breaks and water. But our goal when we leave here is to get there as fast as we can. So there's kind of two trains of thought. Either you go up to Alaska and you train there for the winter, or you leave as close to the race as you can so the dogs, you know, still get their training time here and get there in time just to have a few training runs before you're out on the trail. So that's what we do. We're pretty close to the date. And then what we have to take, the truck is definitely full. There's always, my brother usually goes with Hank, and there it always comes down before they're leaving that, okay, like everything is not going to fit. What's going to be sacrificed?
Yeah. You
know, like an extra bag of dog food, no, extra bale of straw, no. So obviously the sled and everything we need for the drive is on the truck. Everything Hank needs to start the race in the sled is on the truck. But all of the gear they need out on the trail, all the food, all the supplies, we ship that ahead of time.
Okay.
So that all goes to Alaska. It has to be there. I think it's usually there before we even leave home. And then they distribute it out along all the checkpoints so that as you're running, everything you need food-wise or gear-wise is already sitting there waiting for you. It's logistically, it's an incredible thing to watch out.
Yeah. How many dogs are would you take, and how many are on the sled, or do you have extras? How does that work?
Yeah, so Iditarod is 16 dogs on the team, and Yukon Quest, which hangs around four times, that's also 1,000 miles, that's 14 dogs on the team. And then we usually take a couple extra dogs just because you go through.
Right.
Our vet always does vet checks here before we go, but you also go through thorough vet checks up there. So, you know, EKGs and blood panels. So just if anything happened to show up, or if somebody got sick on the way up, like you just never know.
Yeah.
So we always have a couple extra dogs that have trained with the team too that are kind of alternates, I guess you would say.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, I can appreciate. So yeah, go ahead, Tommy.
They're, they're professional athletes, basically.
Absolutely.
You know, so you're doing a lot of high level conditioning, and you know, thinking about it in what we would have as a personal trainer that would help us condition. That's kind of what you're doing for the dog. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember the first time we went, just before we left for our first 1,000-mile race, and we went into our local vet for her just to check all the dogs before they left. And she says, oh my gosh, like this is like feeling the muscles of an Iditarod or an Olympic athlete. Like she's like, I'm used to saying, okay, your dog has to lose weight and another kind of out of shape. Yeah. And she's like, these are like athletes that I have my hands on right now. So yeah, it's incredible what these dogs can do.
Yeah. So with them being so athletic, what is their diet like? What do you feed them?
Yeah, so we certainly, we do feed kibble for most of the kennel, but when we're training for a race team, we do feed a lot of raw. So kibble is mixed in just because they burn 10,000 calories a day when they're competing. So the food they go through is, you know, just insane when you think about it for an animal that size. So their main meal will be a soup, because when it gets really cold, like anybody, they don't like to drink. So by serving a warm soup, they're constantly hydrating. And for us, the soup has kibble, but then it also has beef mixed in as well. And then they snack like every hour and a half to 2 hours, they'll stop and have a snack. The snack could be salmon. The snack could be a piece of steak. It's always raw. So literally every hour and a half to 2 hours, they have food that they're munching on. And then when they stop to rest, that's when they get their big soup meal.
Awesome.
That's fascinating.
It really is. I did a podcast on the Iditarod with Rob, the CEO of the Iditarod. It was early, and so I started the podcast a year ago in December. And it was fascinating. He had worked with professional athletes. So they hired him, not that he came from the Iditarod community or even Alaska or that, but came from the perspective of professional athletes and was taking on all the criticism of the animal rights groups and that. And he said, when I come back, and I'll drop a link to the podcast in show notes. He said, when I come back, I want to be a dog on the Iditarod Trail. It's like the best place to be. You get the best care. You're a professional athlete. Everything's taken care of, you know, and you get to do what you love. So it was pretty cool.
People don't see that side of it often.
No.
I mean, I know the first year we went, the one thing that blew me away was, I think that year they had almost 40 veterinarians on the trail. Now the race was a lot bigger back then, but and every one of these vets had taken holidays on their own time, paid their own airfares, come from all around the world just to get the chance to work with these dogs. Mm-hmm. And if you want to make one of these vets mad, talk about animal rights. And they're like, do people honestly think we would volunteer our time and our holidays to come do something that is cruel to dogs? They're like, it makes no sense. Yeah. So it's, as I say, if people ever get the chance to go watch the Iditarod ceremonial start, it's an incredible event to see.
I'm so jazzed. I still want to do that. That's why I knew it had just wrapped up, because I get all the updates. I signed up for all the updates. I didn't live stream it, but I did get all the updates, and it's on my bucket list now. So it would be pretty cool. So back to it's called Winter Sled Dog Sleds. Is that what the name of the business is?
Winter Dance Dog Sled.
Winter Dance. I'm sorry. I'm looking at
you. Had all the words. It's fine.
I had them transposed there. Winter Dance. I love that name. That's great. And your website is great. I'll put a link to that. But, and you, Tanya, do some speaking and are very, very articulate, lovely way of presenting. And you even do an inspirational, the TEDx talk, which I really enjoyed, where you talk about the analogy of what it's like to achieve that dream and dig so deep and try so hard. You relay a story about your husband, Hank, and how that turns into life lessons for people when we're trying to do something, which, of course, you guys did from the very beginning with moving up to your new place and took a leap of faith, and very inspiring story. So what's on the horizon for you? Are you doing more speaking? Is that something you really enjoy doing? And what's happening with that?
Yeah, it is something I really enjoy. The first one we did was probably almost 10 years ago now, after Hank finished his first 1,000-miler, and a big health company in Ontario reached out and said, oh, you know, would you come and speak to our executives? And I'm like, no, that's not something we do. And so she was an executive. She did not give up. So she was very persistent. And finally, she's like, you know, we pay really, really well. And it's like, of course you do. So I went to Hank again. And he's like, no, you know, effing way am I doing a keynote speech to a bunch of executives in Toronto. And I said, well, it would pay the entry fee for your next 1,000-mile race. And he's like, so he agreed to do one. And we finished it. And she came up and she said, okay, now I need you to come back and see if we can do another one. This was a one-off. So we did do the second one, and we have spoke for that company, I think, 6 or 7 times now. But we never really pursued it. It was just kind of a, you know, somebody asked us to do it.
Awesome.
And then COVID hit. And Canada, of course, took a very different approach than the U.S. did. And we lost pretty much one whole season because we were locked down. Mm-hmm. And so we got to the end of March and like, gosh, like literally, how are we going to care for our dogs for the next 8 months? And so we got very open-minded and speaking as one of the things that came up. And so that's what started again, was literally just to care for our dogs. But out of that, it's become a huge blessing, you know, one of those silver linings. So
yeah,
amazing audiences that we've gotten to speak to that touch our hearts as much as they say we touch theirs. And we get to share our dogs and our lessons. And you know, not a lot of people know dog sledding anymore. It's a disappearing world.
Right.
And we can only take out, you know, 1,500, 2,000 guests a winter. So it's a way for us to let our dogs and the sport of dog sledding touch people, even if they never get to get on the sled themselves. So, so yeah, it's crazy where life takes you. And yet the lessons we've learned from dog sledding are, you know, absolutely relatable lessons to any organization that is dealing with leadership or teamwork challenges or adversity.
Yeah.
But yet the stories are all told through the dogs. So yeah. It breaks down barriers. You know, people hear things on a different level. And we had a chief of police that we spoke to. He was in an audience that somebody else had hired us to speak at. And he told me afterwards, he said, I saw this on the agenda. And he says, I'm like, what a waste of our time. What are we possibly going to learn about leadership from dog sledding? And he said, now you're here speaking to my team.
Yeah.
So,
and I'd like you to come and talk to my people now. Right.
Yeah. So people don't always get the analogy, but when they hear the stories, then it definitely makes sense. So yeah. So this year we're very excited. We've already spoken to Coca-Cola this year. That's our fourth time with them. And police organization we shared with, and a big dog food company. So yes, we're excited for the 6 months of speaking for sure.
Yeah. What I love about it too, I mean, again, on your TED Talk, you're an excellent speaker and you make it, you know, take it to people's lives, which is great. But I also love that you're talking about dogs with a job, and we've become so emotional about our animals to the point that it's a detriment to the animals. I'm a third generation trainer, and I've been around working animals my whole life, and animals that love what they do. I mean, but it's such an emotional topic. And so I love that you're reaching people on that level. That's exactly, you know, you're emotional, but yet you have a practicality about it. And I love that. So good for you, because we need more people to talk honestly and transparently about what our animals do, and without, you know, we get the criticism, but you're reaching people who would probably be the critics if they didn't hear you. So it's interesting.
Some of them, yes.
Yeah.
I had a gentleman reach out last fall after a big talk, and he goes, one of my friends is an activist against animals.
Yeah.
And he said, I have heard all kinds of horrible things about dog sledding. He said, I believe that was dog sledding. And he said, after hearing your stories and your love for your dogs, he said, I really have to relook at what she told me.
Right.
So
love it.
That's not the reason we speak, but it is a wonderful side benefit that people do understand the depth of love between a musher and their dogs. And that hopefully, you know, I always open with, we feel a little bit like the Duttons on Yellowstone. You know, we are living a dying lifestyle that people do not understand. They do not understand the relevance. They do not understand the connection. So if I can help educate people while I'm helping them with their leadership and their teamwork, then that's just a massive bonus.
Yeah, that's the reason I do the podcast too, because the way I grew up was such, I was so privileged to grow up with animals. And this is elephants and camels and llamas and those kind of animals. And very misunderstood on how we should handle them and what's best. My dad always reminded us we do what's best for the animal. But it's you know, more than 93% of the United States are urbanites. You're up in Canada, but I'm guessing your statistic, you know, our cities. Yeah. And so as we get urban societies, we lose that interaction with, you know, somebody out there in I always say that. Where are the activists during the blizzard when the farmer, or like you guys with your dogs, are out with your Carhartts on and your warm clothes taking care of the animals? We don't sit in our house behind our keyboards. You have to actually go out, whatever the weather, whatever the circumstance. And that's mm-hmm. what gets lost. So the more stories we tell about that, I think the better. And it's such a privileged way of life. I mean, it's kind of like if people only understood, they would stop, you know, being so critical and listening to the negativity. But the negativity makes millions of dollars. So we know that.
Oh, yeah. If not billions.
Billions, yeah. It's offshore accounts. I've done podcasts. Yeah, on yeah. that as well. So
it's, yeah. So that's one of the things I love about the policing groups that we get to speak to is they get our stories at such a deep level.
Yeah.
Because they understand the life and death decisions that come with being a team.
Yeah.
And in dogs, learning it's life and death decisions. And Hank's life depends on those dogs as much as those dogs depend on him. And that's not a relationship most people understand with a pet. I mean, they love their pet. They would do anything for their pet, but their life doesn't depend on that pet physically. And when you're dealing with working animals, that partnership is very much a life and death and a total dependence partnership. And it's sad. People don't understand the beauty of a relationship like that.
Boy, really well said, Tommy. I love that because you and I both deal with working animals and train for that, and we know the benefit to the animals too, instead of dumbing them down. Or yeah,
developing that relationship is just so meaningful, and a lot of people don't understand that at all.
No.
And allowing their natural behaviors in that. I mean, I train dogs locally for people when I'm home, and I do it because I feel bad for these dogs that don't have a foundation. These are dogs living in a house, getting too fat, and you know, getting treated, begged basically to do whatever they're supposed to do. And I continually come home and say, boy, that dog would be great in agility. That dog would be great in a circus. That dog would, they want a job. Like they're ready, you know.
They love a job. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And the wrong breeds, you know. No, not couch potatoes, but like mini Aussies and border collies and dogs that are going to move whether you want them to or not and get into trouble. Yeah. Actually, I had a Pomsky.
They don't move, they're going to get into trouble.
I had a Pomsky, little Pomsky, and she, God, what a beautiful blue eyes, that husky look. Boy, did she dig up my yard. I had to stay on her, you know. I couldn't just turn her loose on her own because she was busy, but adorable. But yeah, it's really neat. I love this. Like I said, I want to check out the Iditarod sometime, but I get to Canada once in a while, so maybe at some point I'll get up your way. That would be a lot of fun.
That would be awesome. We'd love to welcome you.
Tell us about your children. They're all involved, too. You have a great website with a meeting everybody, and I love that you got pictures of your kids as little toddlers like I grew up, you know, with the dog and the sled. It's adorable. So how are they involved and what's up with those, your kids?
Yeah. I mean, we have four children. They range from 16 to 24 now. So our 24 year olds, I mean, they all have, you know, Hank and I followed our dream and they have to follow their dreams. If that means they stay here with us. Awesome. But you know, we certainly don't expect that. So Logan, our oldest, he's going through for a commercial pilot, but he still works for us in the winters. And Dustin, our second son, he actually is out on the East Coast. He's a commercial diver. So this is the first winter he didn't guide with us, so we all missed him dearly. But awesome. For the movie, he did fly back to help us for 2 weeks, which was wonderful. So he got to be part of that. And then the girls are 18 and 16, and they still help out. You know, our 18-year-old just graduated, and she's unsure where she wants her future to go. So she's with us full time. And her 16-year-old helps out, too. And they all drive sleds. They've all raced since the time they were 3 and 2 years old.
Love it.
So growing up was, you know, I mean, a lot of people would say we're wrong, but the kids grew up helping with chores. You know, they helped look after the puppies, the fun part, but they also helped feed dogs and, you know, clean pens. And that was just part of life. And I remember at one point our boys, they were probably around 10, were like, you know, our friends don't have to do this. I'm like, no, but your friends don't get to go and take a month off school to go to Alaska either. And they were like, well, that's true.
Yeah.
So And then there was a trade up. Yeah. And then there was a time that, you know, they wanted to go back to Alaska. They never wanted to go back to Disney. They wanted to go to Alaska. So you never know where things will take you. Right. But it has given them all a work ethic for sure.
Yeah.
And it's taught them entrepreneurship. We always joke they would probably grow up and be bankers in downtown Toronto, but that doesn't seem to be the path that most of them are heading on. So there's a lot of lessons. And I mean, you know, unfortunately, the sad thing with dogs, as you guys know, is they don't live as long with us as us. So
yeah,
there's a lot of goodbyes. And, you know, that teaches life lessons too. Not something we certainly set out wanting them to know, but it does teach you the preciousness of time and life and living in the moment. So yeah, hopefully, you know, 10, 20 years down the road, they look back on this and go, that was a pretty unique childhood we had. Hopefully that's kind of the best we can hope with our children, right?
Yeah.
Well. Sounds like a great way to grow up.
Yeah. It's like the farm families. I've done a lot of stories about agriculture on this podcast, and I always say they're not, and other people have confirmed this, they're not the kids in trouble with the principal. You know what I mean? They're the ones, and I grew up that way. I wasn't an ag family, but I grew up in the circus and exhibited animal world, and we all had a job. Farm families, whether you're a toddler or grandma, everybody's got a job, but we're missing that in society, in my opinion. We don't understand teamwork. We don't know there's something bigger than us, you know. I didn't have an electric curling iron when I was young, you know. We didn't even have electricity half the time. We were mobile, so it was the work. It was the animals, and my kids did a little bit of that because I married outside of the animal industry, and both of them used their time with the circus and animals for their college essays to demonstrate how hard they worked.
Absolutely, because it is, right?
It set them apart. It really did.
Absolutely.
They didn't understand other kids in the same way because they did understand, and they did it. They had a joyful, you know, certain things they didn't like, but I mean, from changing tires and mobile equipment, you know, that's why I asked you about logistics are on my mind because I've traveled all over with animals. And two, taking care of the animals and the loss, the crises, and the joys are high. You know, we're peaks and valleys. Some people just like that. Absolutely.
Huge peaks and valleys, right? I mean, Hank didn't get to finish his first Iditarod.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can remember the girls were too young to remember this, although they were in Alaska with us. But I remember the boys, like, they were crying. Like, they were so upset.
Oh, yeah.
You know, how come my daddy doesn't get to finish? Because they grew up knowing about that dream. And as I, you know, it's one of the stories I tell in our presentation when we went back the next year and finished the Yukon Quest. And then the next year we went back to the Iditarod and finished it. And, you know, the greatest lesson that Hank taught our children that day that he finished the Iditarod is there is no failure unless you give up. You know, you've just found a way that didn't work.
Yeah.
Because they watched him fail, quote unquote fail. And then 2 years later, they watched him cross that finish line and be a chase for almost 15 years.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, that's a lesson that can only be taught by seeing, right? We can speak, but then we can teach by actually doing.
Yeah. Yeah. We model. I worked right alongside the kids, and I think that was a little uncommon too, because I was the mom and the female, but again, I say we're like farm families, circus people. We just speak more languages and travel.
Absolutely.
But everybody has a job, and it takes all of us and great environment.
And the stories you end up having.
Yeah. Right?
It's great. And the adventures and the people that you meet.
Yeah. We're great at cocktail parties, right, Tanya?
Yeah, lots of stories.
Lots of stories, right. So anything else, Tommy?
Yeah, so I think a lot of our listeners are probably average pet owners, and we discuss a lot on the podcast sort of breed standards and stereotypes, and Huskies, I think, have a pretty big reputation as far as stereotypes go, as being high energy, as you've mentioned. What tips or suggestions would you make to an average pet owner if they were thinking they maybe wanted to get a Husky? What are your thoughts on them being, you know, an average pet in an average home, not running a couple hundred miles at a time? How would you go about doing that? How would you go about selecting that dog? Would you select that type of dog?
It's definitely a dog you really want. It's all about, don't take us in his example that just got a Husky and didn't know what we were getting into. if you have a lifestyle that can cater to a husky, they will be the most incredible animal you've ever had. But if you don't have a lifestyle that can adjust to what they need, and what they need is tons of exercise, it's tons of stimulation, they are going to be a nightmare for you. And unfortunately, you're probably going to become one of the hundreds of people that call us when that husky is 4 to 12 months old and destroying their place and just absolutely a nightmare in their life because they can't give it what it needs and they're trying to find a new home. So please do your homework. If you're somebody who runs, bikes, walks for miles a day, a husky will be one of the best pets you can get because they will be step by step and loving every second of it. Or if you're somebody that wants that lifestyle, again, an absolutely ideal dog because they will drag you out that door. But if you're somebody who likes to come home from work and just relax, a husky is not going to fit into your lifestyle. They won't, because unfortunately it's just not who they are. You know, there's breeds that will love that lifestyle, yeah. But it's not husky. Other thing is they are not a watchdog. A lot of people kind of associate that intimidating, gorgeous northern look with being a watchdog. We had 5 at the time in the city, and we got broke into and they stole our vehicle, our keys, like everything. And when we called the police and they came and the police are looking at the 5 dogs, it was middle of the night. They're like, well, where were the dogs? And we're like, you don't know huskies very well because they're like here. And they're like, you know, it's easy to meet a friendly dog. If a husky is not a friendly dog, it's had something done to it to make it that way because their nature is they love everyone. If you want a watchdog, husky is not the dog to have. And outside of that, just socialize it. I mean, they love people. They love other animals. Cats, they can be great with. They have a reputation of not being great with cats. But if they're raised with cats, we have cats. We never had a problem. But if you're bringing in an adult husky and you have a cat, that's something you do want to be cognizant of because that prey drive is still very strong in them. And if they haven't grown up with smaller animals, they see them as prey.
Yeah. Good advice.
That's really good. Yeah, good information, because I think a lot of people see them and they go, oh, they saw the Disney movie. They see the dream there, but they don't realize what goes into actually owning them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they are, and even from a grooming point of view, like people always say, you know, they shed twice a year. They've never owned a husky if they they shed twice a year because they shed all the time. So. Yeah. Buckets and buckets of hair. So yeah, and I mean, we have so many of them. Obviously, our life is literally, you know, gone to the huskies, but they are not for everybody.
Yeah, good question, Tommy, good advice. Yeah. I've encountered a couple in my training, and because I have a bit of a problem with my hand, I'm not doing big dogs as much, but it's always an issue with they're not getting the movement and that. On one podcast, Tommy, I told you about a scooter I saw. Somebody who'd actually worked with sled dogs came up with this contraption, and they're selling it now, more mainstream. But it's a scooter, and it has the ties so you can hook the dog on the side. So a dog that, you know, wants to move, get its exercise, and you stay on the scooter, and it takes you. I still need to get one of those. My poodle will probably not take me very far, but
no.
One thing I should add too, Tommy, is I mean, dog sledding, as it's kind of decreasing, unfortunately, just for many reasons, weather and, you know, expenses and everything else. But one side of the sport that is increasing dramatically is for people that have one or two huskies. So canny cross is when you run with a husky in front of you. Ski joring is cross-country skiing with a husky in front of you. Bike joring is bike with a husky in front of you. And there's competitions all around North America. And it's a very welcoming community. And if you just have, you know, one or two huskies, it's a great way to get out and meet people and let your dog do what they love to do. So there's a lot of clubs in urban areas that people can join. And yeah, so it's a great socialization and, you know, very stimulating for the dogs too.
Awesome.
Yeah, I would have never known about that. That's great.
Yeah, I'll put that in show notes. I'll look that up. So, all right. Anything, Tommy, anything else? Tanya, anything you'd like to leave us with? The listeners, again, primarily people who might have pets and misunderstood about the whole animal world itself, and or anything about your business that you want to leave us with?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, in 25 years of business, certainly we get people call that are worried that dog sledding is fair to the dogs, that the dogs enjoy it. And I've said the same thing for 25 years, is if you come and watch our dogs get ready to run and you have any doubts that they don't absolutely love to do what they do, I will happily give you your money back. And in 25 years, no one has ever asked. So all I would say is if you hear the negative, which as you said, there's so much negative about everything to do with animals out there right now, just take a few minutes and either go to a dog sled race, watch a dog sled race, and just educate yourself on how much the dogs love to do what they do. Because I can't imagine a world where dogs aren't allowed to run as part of the team. They love to run and play in the yard, just like any dog park. But they see a harness, they see what we call a gang line, which is the ropes that they run with. And it just goes to a whole other level, because the joy they get from running as a team, and we don't have time, but I mean, some of the stories we have from our races of how they work together as a team defies what most people think are possible with animals.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I do love the story about, was it Maverick who likes to do 180? Yeah. You always have that one animal who's exceptionally smart.
He's just a bit too smart.
Yeah. My father always had a saying, you have to be a little smarter than the animals you're training or working with. And I laugh all the time. Tommy and I have talked about this. I'll step outside my training ring and say, I got to up my game. They're smarter than I am at the moment.
Happens to us quite often, actually.
That's a great thing because it keeps us on our toes.
It's a wonderful
right?
thing. Yeah.
Well, thank
Absolutely.
You, Tanya. This has been wonderful. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Tommy, that was a really fun interview. I'm really jazzed. The Iditarod I did a year ago, the podcast got me inspired, and now I'm inspired all over again. Really neat.
Yeah, what a really cool story, really interesting life and lifestyle.
And I love the life lessons for her family, and, you know, hopefully people with their pet dogs are listening to a lot of the stuff that she spoke about. I think some good takeaways from that. So I think we'll leave it at that, because it's been a lot of doggone good information. So I hope you'll subscribe, rate and review the podcast, and be sure and share it, because it's important for us to tell these stories and to help people really learn about all the really cool things animals can do and have done. And as we become more urbanite, important to tell these stories. So thank you, Tommy.
Thank you, Heidi.
All right. I hope you'll join us next time. We got a lot more doggone good information.